Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. I have a great interview coming up with Darma Kelleher, but first we got some things from Justine. What do you have for us today, Justine?
Well, I think we've got some great press coverage of the Gay Mystery Podcast. Why don't you tell us about the two articles that came out in the past week?
Well, one is Closeted Stance Magazine. It's an online magazine, as far as I know. And we were rated one of the top five podcasts during
Gay Podcasts.
Gay podcast for Pride Month.
Yes.
So that's quite an honor. Pretty excited to have seen that. And if anybody wants to check out the other podcasts that are listed, it's Closeted Stance is where they would go. I think it's closetedstance.com, but I'm not absolutely positive. They can Google it.
Yeah, or they can check your Facebook feed and find the link.
But that was quite the honor.
Yeah.
And
what's the newest one today?
Newest one today is we are being featured with a couple other podcasts in Lambda Literary Magazine. So that's
Lambda
pretty
Literary is a big deal.
That is a big deal. So
you've now arrived.
We're going to start beating Joe Rogan as the number one podcast.
Sounds good. Sounds great.
We can get $100 million deal from Spotify like he did.
That's right. Well, you know, we'll all settle for a couple thousand from Spotify.
I'm not holding my breath for either.
So, Brad, you were featured in an article, too, where you asked to recommend your favorite gay mystery. Where was that?
It was Kings River Life magazine, and it's an online magazine, and they asked several of us. I recommended Carved in Bone by Michael Nava, which is currently my favorite novel that off the top of my head. I just love that novel. And then you can say what the others were.
Well, there were two people who recommended Fade Out by Joseph Hansen, and his detective is Dave Brandstetter. And that is regarded as one of the pillars of modern gay fiction, gay mystery writing. And the book I'm going to review today is by another classic author, Victor J. Bannis. You know, Recurred Tales, that I'm a part of, we are republishing a number of classic gay authors and their mysteries, as well as some of the literary fiction books that have gone out of print. But Victor J. Bannis's books have never gone out of print. His Man from Camp, which was originally meant as a standalone, but then was so popular that he did an entire series. That was written several years before Joseph Hansen wrote Fade Out. And he was someone who encouraged Joseph Hansen and promoted his novels when Joseph Hansen was getting started. So Victor J. Bannis is quite famous in the genre. He died last year, 2019. And the book I am doing today is called A Deadly Kind of Love. It's from one of his later mystery series.
I like the title.
Yeah, it's the first in his Tom and Stanley mystery series. It was written in 2011. It was republished in 2018. So in 2011, there are always, you know, the little technological quirks that if you notice that it was written in 2018, you'd be surprised. So that's why I'm mentioning 2011. They have cell phones, but their cell phones don't have Google Maps on them yet. So they always have to print out maps for where they're going. This is a follow-up on his Deadly Mystery series. Tom and Stanley are two of the characters from there. So with many series, book one starts it out, and you can just start fresh, and I know you'd like me to tell you this. The book can be read as a standalone, but it's got serious spoilers for the previous books in the Deadly Mystery series. And it basically talks about how they met, and it also talks about how they got some of the scars that they're dealing with, both physical and psychological. Tom and Stanley were both homicide detectives when they met, and they started dating, and then they left the force and they are now working together as PIs. Tom considers himself straight, but is madly in love with Stanley. And several times he discusses the fact that he's straight and doesn't really like the gay scene, doesn't participates because Stanley likes it. But there's a little throwaway about how once he was tempted by another man, And, you know, that piqued my interest a bit. Stanley, despite the fact he was a homicide cop, really doesn't like being a PI. He always kind of wanted to be a designer growing up. But this is what he does. He wants to do it with Tom. Tom is really the superhero kind of character, can take on, you know, bad guys more than one at a time. Stanley, on the other hand, can hold his own, probably can only take on one guy at a time, but together they make a formidable team.
Yeah, would you say this is more of a suspense than a mystery?
No, it is definitely a mystery.
Okay.
They get called down, and I picked this book up. I read through a number of the captions on his book to see which one I wanted to pick up and read for the show. And I picked this book because it was set in Palm Springs. And I always like a little Palm Springs.
Well, we do suspense here also. Just because Tom kicks ass, I thought maybe it was suspense.
It's a straight mystery. They get called down to Palm Springs. One of their friends is staying at the Winter Inn in Palm Springs, which is a fictional high-end resort where older gay gentlemen with much money and used to a lot of luxury come and stay. And there are a lot of pretty boys who hang around the pool and trade on their looks. The resort has individual suites, which are all themed for movie stars. There's the Joan Crawford suite and the Jeanette McDonald suite and the Marilyn Monroe suite. And everything is the over-the-top luxury. You can't get a steak in the restaurant because they serve only high-end Pacific Rim seafood.
I wish this place was real. It sounds wonderful.
I have to say I was about, you know, three quarters in and I was looking to see if it was real and if I could just go and get a drink at the bar rather than paying the $1,000 a night that the room started at. So one of their friends ends up there in a comp room and it starts with him coming back to his room and climbing into bed after a drunken night, rolling over and finding a naked dead body in his bed.
Oh, what a bad way to wake up.
And so he calls Tom and Stanley and they come racing down. They get to work with the cooperation of the Palm Springs Police Department and they work very closely with the Palm Springs Police Department to solve this murder. Along the way, there's a couple of other murders because you know how these detective novels always go. One murder's never quite enough and they get into a fair amount of trouble along the way.
I like a high body count.
Yeah, it's a high body count, and I always like sort of a thrilling, you know, deal with the killer at the end action scene.
And you told me you have a little secret about a new classification.
And this is a classic recommendation.
Classic, a new one, our
classic
first.
Classic recommendation, really. I think Victor J. Bannis, if you're, you know, delving into the genre, he is one of the greats, and you would do well to read some of his books, and this is one that I picked up.
Sounds like a great choice.
It was. It was an enjoyable read.
It sounds like a fun read.
It's a fun read, yes. It almost got a delightful, but it's really a classic.
It could be classically delightful.
You know, if we start going crossovers, some of these books, and I think I'd like started putting things in three different categories. No, at some point I got to have one category. If I got to make up new categories, I will. But these crossover categories, it's just going to get way too confusing.
Yeah, so you're right. So we'll stick with classic. That's a good
maybe
category.
One of our fans can do a spreadsheet of you know, all the categories and which books have gone into them.
Hey, anybody wants to do that, send it to info@gaymysterypodcast.com. We'll be glad to have that.
Sounds terrific. All right, Brad, we'll let you get on with the interview.
Okay. Thank you, thank you, Justine.
Talk to you later.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, gaymysterypodcast.com. Darma Kelleher writes gritty crime fiction with a feminist kick and is one of the only openly transgender authors in the genre. In addition to her novels, her work has appeared in anthologies and on Shotgun Honey. She is a member of Sisters in Crime, the International Thriller Writers, and the Alliance of Independent Authors. She lives in Arizona with her wife and her feline overlords. Hello, Dharma. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Brad.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. I have to ask, how many feline friends do you have?
Currently two. We lost one in December, so we did have three. Now we're down to two.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, it's good that you have cats because it's I think it's important for an author to uphold our image by having at least one cat.
Absolutely.
Now, unfortunately, I can't because my husband has allergies. So I think my best bet is to get a pipe and a golden retriever.
There you go.
And then I'll still fit in. So
there you go. Yeah.
I'll need to do that eventually. So enough with the silliness because we're going down to business. We have a lot to cover. You write two series.
I do.
You write the Jinx Blue Bounty Hunter series and the Shay Stevens Outlaw Biker series.
Yep.
Now, your next release is from the Shay Stevens Outlaw Biker series, and it's book number 3.
Right.
And it's due out in October. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it should be out around October 15th.
Okay. So let's talk about Shay Stevens.
Good.
What can you tell me about her?
She's a whole lot of trouble. She is basically, she's a lesbian outlaw biker, if I were to put it that into just a few words. She grew up around, her father was the president of a racist outlaw biker group called the Confederate Thunder, which she thought was just the bomb until she was 15 and her father murdered her mother. And so she ran away and did crime and eventually served time in prison for Grand Theft Auto. And when the first book, Iron Goddess, begins, she's been running a custom motorcycle shop in rural Arizona with a business partner of hers. And so she's, she's trying to live life on the straight and narrow, more narrow than straight. But she keeps getting pulled back into her outlaw biker past. And so it keeps kind of creeping up on her. And so she's trying to learn to face new challenges in new ways. So it's kind of like a lesbian version of Sons of Anarchy, if to compare it with something that people are familiar with.
Well, you had me right at the beginning with lesbian outlaw biker. Now, how does Jinx Blue differ?
Jinx Blue is a lot different. Jinx Blue, she's transgender. She is primarily straight. She spent a year or so as a Phoenix police officer, and then she left that career to be a professional bounty hunter. Bail enforcement officer is her official title. But basically, when people jump bail, she's hired to go and bring them back so that the bail bondsman doesn't have to pay the entire amount of the bail. So she has a more inclination of following the law, but not always. She still kind of lives by her own rules. And she's also got a little geeky side to her. She's really into comic books. And in her spare time, she will cosplay as Wonder Woman or Xena at like Comic-Con events.
So she's actually quite a bit different than Shay.
Oh yeah, definitely. She's a lot more femme than Shay Stevens is.
So how does Shay get into trouble?
It just naturally finds her. The first book, Iron Goddess, opens with her discovering that someone has broken into her custom motorcycle shop, stolen a whole bunch of motorcycles, and shot one of her employees. And so in that case, trouble finds her. And so she reports it to the cops, but then she doesn't trust the cops to do their job. So rather than waiting on them to figure out who did it, she decides to follow clues herself and kind of uses her old style of handling situations with a gun rather than waiting for the police officers to handle it. And so she has a tendency to dig herself deeper into trouble rather than getting out of it. So.
Okay. So definitely trouble finds her.
Trouble finds her. Yeah.
I know a few people like that in my life.
Yep.
Now, what is it that attracts you to crime novels and specifically thrillers?
Oh, As a kid, I read The Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, and as a teenager, I fell in love with Lawrence Block's novels, the Bernie Rodenbaugh burglar series, as well as the Matt Scudder private investigator series. And so I think part of it is that crime fiction centers around the concept of justice, not necessarily the law, but a sense of justice in whatever form that takes. It's about bringing people, holding people accountable for their actions or not. As someone who has experienced a lot of injustice personally, I find that comforting in a way that, like, maybe some people love romance for the happily ever after. It kind of gives them hope. For me, crime fiction gives me hope.
Well, I got to tell you, I get a lot of people on this show that talk about The Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew.
Oh, yeah.
Having read them. I actually never read either.
Oh, really? Okay.
But I have fallen in love with you because Lawrence Block is my favorite writer and nobody else has ever mentioned mm-hmm. him before.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically because the Bernie Rodenbaugh burglar series is wacky. Matthew Scudder is dark.
It is.
The fact that he's so successful, both of them, I try to emulate that.
Right, right, right. Same here.
Good on you. More people should know him. Now, you've told me you've built a brand as a crime fiction author who's trans.
Right.
Rather than a trans fiction author.
Right.
Explain what that means.
Basically, to give you a little context, when I first came out, way back in the dark ages when dinosaurs ruled the earth, back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I started reading queer fiction. So much of what I read was romance and coming out stories and erotica. And they're all important stories that need to be told. But I wanted more than that. I wanted stories that didn't center around the main character's sexuality or gender identity. I wanted something where the main character was like me, queer, but they were just solving crimes or doing whatever, where the story didn't revolve around the character's identity. And there wasn't a lot of that. And so I found that a few authors that were doing that, Catherine V. Forrest and Ellen Hart, were two of my bigger influences in that aspect. But when it comes time to branding myself, I wanted to have that same focus where it's not about Shay Stevens being a lesbian. I don't write romances. More often than not, if she does have a relationship anywhere in the novel, it's probably going to go to shit by the end of the story. Because Shay Stevens is not, she's just, doesn't really care about having a relationship. And so if one pops in and is like, oh, okay, but it's, I don't write romances. I don't write stories where it's about her being a lesbian. And similarly with the Jinx Belew series, it's not a coming out story. It's not a transition story. It's not anything about her being trans, but it is from her perspective as a trans person that shapes her experience. So I wanted to, I brand myself as someone where the focus is on the crime fiction, on the story, on solving crimes, bringing people to justice, the action, the thrills, the excitement, the suspense. And so you don't have to be trans or queer or anything like that to enjoy the stories any more than you have to be a wizard named Harry to either enjoy Harry Potter or the Dresden novels, J.K. Rowling's transphobia aside. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and I'd say 90% of my fans are not queer. And a lot of them tend to be in the older age bracket, my age bracket. And so I find that helps me to reach people, and it helps me to reach readers that might not otherwise be interested in reading about people like me.
Well, I have no problem with there being romance in a crime novel. It's been traditional, or at least sex. But it's refreshing to hear somebody that just doesn't think it's necessary. And kudos to you on that. I'd like to see more that don't see it as a crutch that has to be in there.
Right. I mean, I've got nothing against sex scenes. I have a hard time writing them, honestly. Keeping it interesting because, you know, the thing about sex scenes is it's so easy for it to be boring or just to be, you know, erotic and everything, which is fine. But that's not what I, you know, anytime I'm reading a book and it gets into like a deep erotic sex scene, I'm like, okay, where's the rest of the action? You know, bring on the rest of the story. And it's not because I've got anything against sex. I love sex. Sex is awesome. But I'm reading the story, for the plot, to find out, you know, who did what to whom outside of the sheets. And so when I'm writing, I'll put in a sex scene or part of a sex scene, but usually to serve advancing the story or to show character. I've had a sex scene. It started out as a sex scene and then it got interrupted for comedic effect. Or there was one where it's showing an infidelity between two characters, which advanced the plot. It created more tension. But just having a sex scene in there just to titillate, just not what I'm writing.
Yeah, I totally get it. My most recent novel, I had two sex scenes and I looked at it and I said, they don't serve the plot at all. So I took them out. So, and I'm sure some would have preferred them in there, but they were just there. And like you said, sex scenes are hard to write.
They are.
Because when we have sex, we know pretty much what we like. Mm-hmm. So you kind of just, without being too boring, you pretty much do the same things.
Yeah.
In the novel, you got to find new and creative ways to make it sound interesting. And that's not so easy to do.
And to take it out of the whole mechanics of the act and focus more on the emotion of the act.
Yes.
And so, and that therein lies the challenge. And so for those that write really good sex scenes, kudos to you. But it's just, you know, I also find writing fight scenes equally difficult because again, it's so tempting to get pulled into the mechanics, which can be so boring.
Mm-hmm.
He punched her and she kicked him and blah, blah, blah. And it gets very repetitive very quickly. And so it's really tricky to build the tension and keep the tension and keep showing the shifts in power and holding the reader's attention is a real challenge. So both writing sex scenes and fight scenes are equally difficult for me. But I try to include the fight scenes because I write action thrillers. So.
Well, I hate rules in writing, but one of them that I hear a lot, and I think there's a lot of merit to it, is keep your fight scenes short.
Yes. Because
otherwise, they do get boring.
They do. So. They really do. It's not like in the movies where you can have all kinds of action going on and on and all, because having to describe it slows everything down.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you really got to watch repeated words and just it's very tricky. So yeah, it's not like watching fight scenes in the movies.
No, it's quite a bit different. Now, is there any discomfort with being one of the few trans authors in the genre, or do you view it as an advantage in any way?
I think it's a little bit of both. One of the challenges is, you know, when I was pitching the Shea Stevens series, you know, I went the traditional route originally. And I had a great literary agent. She's still awesome. And she was pitching major traditional publishers. And one of the things that we kept getting back, and this was back when Sons of Anarchy was in its heyday, is we love this story. We just don't know how to market it. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't about white straight guys, you know?
Yep.
And so it was like, oh, well, they're having a lot of trouble with pitching an action thriller with a lesbian protagonist. So when my two book deal didn't get extended out, I was thinking, okay, what do I want to write next? And what I really wanted to write was a story with a trans protagonist. And I'm thinking, well, you know, if they're having trouble with selling action thrillers with a lesbian protagonist, they're not even going to give me the time of day with a story with a trans protagonist. So, because, you know, you hear things like, oh, we already published a trans story this year. Like there's a quota, you know, which is absurd. So
we checked the box.
Yeah, exactly. We checked the box. We did our duty. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. So that was what drove me to start my own publishing company, Dark Pariah Press. But even still, I face obstacles. So when it came time for me to start pitching a trans a story with a trans protagonist, I knew that they weren't going to give me the time of day. So self-published, started my own publishing company, Dark Pariah Press. But even still, I face gatekeepers like Crime-Spree Magazine that choose to not want to review books that are by self-published authors. So I can't get in the traditional route, and going the independent route, there are still industry gatekeepers that say, nope, we don't want your kind here. So in that way, being trans is a bit of a challenge. At the same time, it's one of my unique selling points. I have a lot of great friends, great cisgender friends in the crime fiction community who are very supportive and who treat me as an equal. And so what I bring is my own unique perspective. I'm writing stories that provide a whole new outlook on life, at the same time telling really interesting, entertaining stories.
Well, and I think if I'm correct, it's still in place. Mystery Writers of America, independent publishers are not eligible for their Edgar Award.
Right, exactly.
That leaves out so many people.
It does. So, you know, the traditional publishing industry has been gatekeeping queer people, people of color, and even women for so long. And the awards and the review organizations and all this stuff have been, because they only focus on the tradition published, they are still part of that gatekeeping. And things are starting to change. And there's been some kerfuffle in the international thriller writers of late, which I won't get into here, but basically things are starting to change and people are starting to speak up. And the authors are taking stands, and I feel very good about the change that's coming.
It's good news.
It is.
Okay. Well, now we're a little past halfway, so we're going to take a break for awkward questions authors get.
All right.
And what I'm going to do is you've listened to the show.
I have.
So I'm going to spin the wheel, and these are either questions that we get that are hard to answer or just unusual, or sometimes they're rude. You never know.
Okay.
So give me a second here and we're going to spin the wheel. Okay. Your question is, it's nice that you write, but when do you plan to get a real job?
I already have a real job. It doesn't pay a whole lot, but I do have a day job. I'm currently on short-term disability from that job because I broke my ankle a few months ago. But yeah, I still have a real job. In fact, most writers these days do have a day job.
Yeah, it's harder and harder to make it full-time.
It really is. It really is. The good news is that I'm in my mid-50s right now, so retirement is only like a little more than a decade away. So I just got to hang in there.
Not that you're counting the days, of course.
No, not at all.
Earlier you mentioned your cis friends, and I have a question. At a time when own voices is becoming more important to readers and writers, you support cis authors writing trans characters.
Yes, I do.
Can you elaborate on that?
You know, if they do it right, and by right, I mean that they don't perpetuate harmful stereotypes and that they get feedback from trans people on what they've written before they publish, I think it helps to reach other cis people and helps to inspire other trans people as well. I mean, we've seen depictions of trans people over the decades, and some are better than others. Some of the ugly tropes that I'd like to see less often are trans person as sex worker, which is nothing against people doing sex work. I've got nothing against that. I'm just saying it's too often a trope. Or another one I see all too often is the murder victim, which again is, you know, yes, the fact that trans women are murdered at alarming rates is an issue, But those two tropes shouldn't be the only way that trans people are being depicted. So I want people, I want to see a little bit more variety, a little bit more imagination. That's why I wrote the, I'm writing the Jinx Blue series, because I want people to see that trans people can do other things, you know?
Trans individual getting murdered has been going on for way too long in the, in, well, in real life, but also in the industry, as you said.
Yep.
Now, you say you insist on putting out books that have the same professional quality of traditionally published books.
Yes.
Do you feel other indie authors have that same attitude?
Yes. I think for the large, for the most part, yes, I think they do. The challenge, of course, is having the resources, the money to pay for professional cover design, to pay professional editors. And so, you know, it's quite an investment. I don't make a profit on the books that I sell. I mean, there it is, you know. So I have to invest a lot of my money to produce new books. So I've got an editing deadline coming up next month, and I'm still, you know, trying to make sure I have enough money to pay for that, because it's not cheap. You know, I'll pay, you know, $500 to $1,000 for an editing, for editing. And that's, you know, a few passes, that's with copy editing and proofreading and everything. It's a whole package deal. And then I'll pay, you know, several hundred dollars for a cover design. So I think a lot of the people that are really in it to make it as a profession, to take it seriously, they invest. There are some, and they tend to be more newer authors, think that, oh, I don't have to invest. I can just do it myself. I can put up, you know, a crappy cover and I can just edit myself and no one will know, but people will know. And people do judge books by their covers. A crappy cover usually means a crappy, poor job in editing. And so that's usually an indicator that you're not going to sell any books if you do that. So I think things have improved greatly. The Alliance of Independent Authors has set a high standard for its members. Not that they're going to kick you out if you don't do that, but they tried to establish a standard saying, if you want to sell books, if you want to be a successful author, this is what you have to do.
Yeah, when I talk to new authors and they bring up their covers and want to go the cheap route, I always let them know, you know, there's millions of books on Amazon. And we like to say, don't judge a book by your cover. But when people are looking at all those books, there's got to be something that jumps out at them first.
Absolutely.
Before they ever click that look inside button. Mm-hmm. And if you have a cover that looks like shit, yep, they're going to move on because they're going to assume the rest of the book is the same way.
And to give a little bit of a hot take, some of the major LGBT small presses over the years, and I'm not going to name names, they've put out books with crappy covers for decades. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I don't know how some of them are still in business, because it's just like, This is what you got. I'd hate to bother reading them because they look like amateur covers. I could put something like that together in Microsoft Word. I mean, that's how bad some of them are, which is not to degrade their authors. I mean, they've done a great service as far as putting out queer literature, but some of them really need to up their game.
Well, and what I've heard a lot of complaints is I don't like putting pictures of people on my covers because I like the reader to visualize what they are. But,
right.
But I hear a lot of people with those publishers that say the picture on the cover looks absolutely nothing like what they describe in the novel.
Right.
Just the cover artist thinks, oh, this is perfect. It's hot.
Yeah.
So,
you know, a bare torso or whatever it is, you know.
Yep, exactly. There's a few of those you see out on Amazon, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, you admittedly have a dark, gritty past.
Yes.
And you write stories that are gritty.
Yes.
What does gritty mean to you?
I think gritty means dealing with a lot of difficult choices where there's no right answers, where you have to choose between doing something wrong in one way or doing something wrong in another. And I won't get into too much of my own past, but I, you know, it's so often queer people especially are forced to make difficult choices where there's no right answer. You know, we deal with a lot of oppression, a lot of discrimination. And, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes we have to choose things like doing sex work, even if it's technically illegal, or even if it doesn't make us happy, which, you know, and again, I'm not judging people who do sex work in any way, but it's, we sometimes have to make difficult choices because there's no other options. There are no good options. And so to me, that's what gritty means. It means doing things the best you can when there's no right way to do them.
That's a good explanation. Now, we're living in interesting times.
Yes.
And as they say, and COVID-19 is one. We have political protests. You know, let's just talk about politics in general.
Yeah.
Plus, as you said, you've been living with a broken ankle.
Yes.
How do you remain creative through all of this?
For me, creativity is my solace. You know, when I'm dealing with a lot of anxiety, a lot of frustration, a lot of negative feelings, there's nothing like writing a fight scene or a, killing off a bad guy. Or and, you know, on the page, of course, not in real life. and so I find writing to be helpful in that aspect. And so, and you know, when the anxiety gets too much, you know, I have to rely on my tools. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I will share that much. And, I've been sober for many years, but I still, in times like this, I still have to use those tools to maintain my sobriety and my serenity. And so I'll do gratitude lists. I'll meditate. I'll do whatever it takes to make it through so that I can once again be creative. And it can be a challenge sometimes.
Finally, who are you reading now?
Oh, currently I'm reading Sarah Paretsky. She's one of my big major influences. You know, she not only did she write the ongoing V.I. Warshawski series, but she's also the founder of Sisters in Crime, which is an organization helping women crime authors, and men are welcome too. We call them Misters in Crime. And so I'm reading one of her books, and then I've got a whole bunch in my to-be-read books. I've got the latest by Tracy Clark, who writes the Cass Rains series. I can't remember the name of the latest book, but it's really, I'm really looking forward to, I read the first two in her series, and I'm looking forward to this one. I've got your latest is already on my Kindle, and so
thank you.
Body on a Hill, right?
Yeah, A Body on the Hill.
Body on the Hill, see? And Walter Mosley's latest, I can't wait to read that. And I've pre-ordered S.A. Cosby's Blacktop Wasteland, so I'm really looking forward to reading that one as well. So I've got a lot of great books in my lineup.
Sounds like your Kindle is bursting like mine.
Oh, it is. I'm never short of something to read, something fantastic to read.
Well, Dharma, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise.
You're a lot of fun to talk to. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.